Welcome to In Business. This is the programme first broadcast in the UK on the 19th of June 2008. This week, Peter Day goes in search of happiness.
You don't see that rat in the bathroom?
Yeah.
Leave that plastic on my head.
Oh, I know that rat.
We're in a house in Belfast, and some of the happiest workers in the UK are busy installing a whole heating system in one working day. They work for a company called Heat. It specialises in central heating installation and maintenance for social housing organisations. How do I know they're happy? Well, Heat recently came out as number one in the Sunday Times list of top 100 companies to work for. It's an award made to companies volunteering to enter the competition, compiled from a lengthy questionnaire of what the workers think about their colleagues, their management, their pay and benefits, all the things that go into feeling good about going to work. Noel Gallagher leads the Heat team of five on site. We're looking at happy companies, and here's the happiest company to work for.
There you go, yeah.
Yeah, and is it really?
It is right enough. Aye, sure, you couldn't beat it, like, you couldn't beat it. So you start in the morning there at 7 o'clock and you work through, you know, your day's your own, you get rewarded for working hard. They're making our life easy by treating us well, and we're, you know, we're doing our job and doing it well, and in turn it makes their job easy too, you know, and it's pushed on to the client too, because we're happy, they're happy and everyone's happy.
But how do you get a workforce as content as that? Economists and business experts are getting more and more interested in happiness as a way of measuring things the numbers alone don't recognise. Lots of companies would like to make their workforce happy, not a lot know how to do it. And this company called Heat knows that well. It started life as a nationalised coal board business. 10 years ago, post-privatisation, it was struggling. Then new owners put staff welfare at the centre of their concerns, with health and safety training courses and family fun days. And, says Heat's communications director John Morgan, the company sat back to await the results.
We went for our Investors and People Award.
And you naturally assumed you would get it, didn't you?
Correct.
Smug, weren't you?
Yeah, exactly. And that probably was our feeling, in that we thought this was another tick box exercise. But when the actual report came back again and the guy said that he couldn't recommend us, I can remember firing it against the back wall and saying, who the hell does that guy think he is and what does he know? Because we do all these lovely things with our people, and it's near time I went and seen the minister and asked them what they're playing at with this award.
So what did you do? How did you respond to that? It was a shock.
Well, about 2 days later, after the steam had sort of stopped coming out of my ears and that, myself and the managing director sat down and we read the report, and there was one glowing factor that came out of it. We weren't engaging with our site people. The senior management and the admin team within headquarters were getting the message, but we weren't getting the message clearly out to site.
And that's where the bulk of the work was being done?
Correct, that's where the bulk of the work was being done, and that's where we then said, no, well, we need to take senior people out of the operation and get them to communicate clearly with their staff. And we just said, we've got to get out there, we've got to find out what makes these guys tick, and we've got to get underneath their skin. And 5 years later, we feel that we're getting there well.
A familiar story, in fact. The bosses had one idea about how the business worked and the staff had quite another. Now HQ goes out to meet the staff. A mobile training unit goes round the sites, and there are mobile health checks too. Taking extra effort to keep distant staff in the loop seems to pay off, says Noel Gallagher.
It's the respect that you get, and there's always help. You do your work. If you have any problems, there's supervisors the whole way up the ladder to help you out.
And they're interested in helping you rather than in telling you to get back to work and stop moaning.
No. That's why it works so well, you know what I mean? And then they do other things, you know, that other firms wouldn't do. You know, they bought us a big leisure centre type place, you know, and there only 2 weeks ago they put up a barbecue for us there, you know, 100 people or plus.
And you like that kind of stuff, do you?
Oh, gosh, sure, who doesn't? Free drink, free grub, do you know what I mean?
Now, what lessons does the story of Heat, the company which won the Best Company to Work For award, have for others? Stay fairly small and close to your customers, perhaps. But why does happiness at work matter so much? Wouldn't we all prefer to grumble a bit and be left free to get on with the job? Here's some recent business school research which is making hard-headed business people think twice about happy workers. Alex Edmonds is a British-born professor at the distinguished Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. He had the bright idea of examining how the best American companies to work for performed for their investors.
I looked at a list of the 100 best companies to work for in America, which is published by Fortune magazine. And in quite simple terms, what I did is just looked at whether the companies on this list actually did better in terms of stock performance. And my results were quite striking. Between 1998 and 2005, the companies on this list earned 14% per year, which was over double the market's return. The market only returned 6%.
And that is striking enough for you to connect the two things, happiness and corporate financial performance, rather closely. I mean, this is a big, big difference, isn't it?
Yeah, well, the result that I've just mentioned is alone insufficient to say that there's a relationship, because it could be many other things are driving that superior performance. It could be that the companies on that list happen to be in industries that did well, and there's nothing specific about satisfaction. So I had to do a lot of follow-up tests to try to find out it was actually satisfaction that was the driver. You do have a small sample, and with a small sample you often have problems, but I did things such as taking out outliers. I didn't want my results to be driven just by a couple of firms that happened to do exceptionally well, such as Google, which is number one on the list. So when I controlled for outliers, controlled for all of these other characteristics, I still got this portfolio doing well.
What kind of companies were sort of lower down your list?
One company which is known for being very caring for its workers is Costco. So Costco offers employees healthcare benefits after just 6 months, and it pays them 100% of the premiums. And you compare them with Walmart, which is their closest competitor, and Walmart now owns Asda in the UK. They're known for being pretty cutthroat. But despite Costco maybe paying more than they need to, the Costco performance has been very strong. So one reason for this is that in return for their company providing them more benefits, the workers may well provide greater effort than they need to, as defined by the employment contract.
Because I suppose, to put it into its historic context, we had the rise of mass production in industry in America and then the rest of the world, governed by the stopwatch, wasn't it? It was how much we get out of these people performing their daily jobs on the shop floor. To make it any subtler than that took a lot of time and effort and thought, and maybe many companies still, on the whole, think about their workers rather with that stopwatch tick, tick, tick in the back of their mind.
I think that's entirely right. So one question that I often get asked is that given that my study is now known by many people in industry, is it going to change the way that managers think about their workers? And it may not do. So even though there's this study showing that long-term stock price performance is strong if your workers are happier, it may well be that the stopwatch mentality still stays. And the reason for this is that what I'm looking at the study is long-term stock price performance. So if you're investing today by training your workers, perhaps in 5 years' time, your company's going to perform better. But many managers themselves are responding to shareholders, and sometimes shareholders can be very short-termist.
Alex Edmonds at the Wharton School in Philadelphia. He says this superior corporate performance seems to be consistent through booms and busts right back to 1984. For years, people have talked about the importance of job satisfaction and corporate morale, but nobody had apparently thought to pin down its impact on company performance in this way. What Professor Edmonds has discovered has got the investment experts at the big UBS bank in London interested. They've been looking for performance indicators that go wider than just the financial facts and figures, and they think that happy companies just might be under-regarded investment opportunities. Julie Hudson heads the socially responsible investment team at UBS. She thinks it makes sense to suppose that companies which handle their human capital better than others would outperform in the long term. More than that, happy employees might help their companies survive.
I think companies that have very well-engaged workforces are on balance likely to be better set to survive a time like this, because when conditions are volatile, it's very, very hard work. So you can imagine if motivation drops and energy drops, then the company is less likely to survive through that than if your employees are really going for it and fighting back.
In this bland phrase, human capital, which always makes me slightly ouch because it's looking at people a little like the old sort of time and motion people did as machinery, as another asset for the company. But anyway, in this bland phrase are contained considerable complexities, aren't there, of happiness is one way of putting it, but morale, commitment, maybe the very essence of some companies is bound up in that human capital phrase and what people think of the company they're working for. It's much more complicated than those two words make it appear.
I think you've just described it very well, actually. I think it boils down to the relationship between employees and the company, and particularly where intellectual property, so that basically means innovation and ideas, matter, the relationship between the employees, the company, each other, employees and management, all become very, very important in the overall dynamic and really can affect performance.
Julie Hudson at UBS Investment Bank in the City of London. Another expert at the Open University Business School has a rather different view. Jane Henry is head of the OU's Centre for Human Resources and Change Management.
Although academics, consultants and others would like it if companies where people were satisfied performed better, meta-analyses that have looked at a number of studies trying to tease out this relationship have only produced a moderate correlation. So although being more satisfied at work helps performance, it's perhaps not as strong a relationship as people would like.
Even so, says Jane Henry, it is still important for companies to try to create happy workforces. How do they do that, I wondered.
First of all, we might ask, what makes people happy? And I would argue that overwhelmingly social relationships are a major factor. Now, people at work often rate themselves happier than those who are not at work, or rather who are unemployed. And one of the reasons for that is that work affords a lot of opportunity for social relationships.
No problem. She will give you a wee shout tomorrow then before we call.
In Belfast, Heat, chosen as the best company to work for in the whole of the UK, puts great emphasis on companies' social events and outings, and in celebrating staff achievements. Here in the call centre, they told me about a bowling trip they'd had recently, and then I met the managing director's personal assistant.
Now, this is really special here. I'm with the chicken lady, aren't I?
Yes, you are indeed, yes.
Who are you?
I'm Tracy Evans. We give out Easter eggs at Easter for our staff, and I dressed up in seasonal outfit, which was a chicken, and went around the sites to help.
Couldn't get the bunny, could you?
I wasn't allowed to dress as the bunny.
Why not?
I was told a chicken would be more appropriate.
All right, so you for the eggs, I see,
yes,
the connection.
Exactly, yes.
And these are special eggs, of course.
Of course, they were iced with thank you, with a little token of appreciation for them.
£50.
It was indeed, yeah.
Isn't it all a bit silly? There's no need for a company to do this, is there?
Oh, there is. It just breaks the day up and brightens their day up when we go out to site dressed up.
And that is exactly the sort of behaviour that this man will stand up and cheer.
I'm Alexander Kjolf, the Chief Happiness Officer.
Oh dear, it sounds absolutely dreadful. Alexander Kjolf is a Danish self-styled happiness at work consultant. He used to own an information technology business in which he put staff happiness as a top priority. Then he sold the firm and decided to devote his entire working life to the business of being happy. This is what may happen when he gets involved in someone else's company.
The sort of the Danish Halloween is in January. And the managers actually dressed up in costumes. The CEO came as an oil sheik, there was a musketeer, there was a court jester, and Cleopatra. They passed out sweets, pastries, and it really made people happy to see, you know, okay, our bosses don't take themselves that seriously.
This business was a Danish insurance company, full of tension and absenteeism and a flood of resignations at the end of every month. So how did he get these gloomy office workers to loosen up and begin to enjoy coming into work?
One thing I taught them that they really, really took to heart and really made a difference was remember to say good morning when you come in. And I know how banal this sounds, but it makes a huge difference. And what I taught them was that you must greet each and every one of your coworkers with, you know, a loud, cheerful good morning, shake his hand, look him in the eyes. And what this means is that you establish the good relationships in the workplace from the very beginning of the workday, and those tend to persist throughout the day. I taught them to praise each other. I taught them to do those little random acts of workplace kindness. I got them talking about what makes them happy at work, what is their, you know, the favorite five things about your job. And I know how banal this sounds, but it works. It really works.
It works in measurable terms. You reduced turnover, did you?
We reduced employee turnover. We reduced absenteeism rates. We used a questionnaire to measure happiness at work before, after, and again after 3 months. And we could see a huge improvement. I also got emails from the employees saying how much better things work now.
You see, I can feel my hackles rising at this. Big brother big brother boss telling me how to behave and to smile and to say good morning and things. And
yeah, I know
this is merely guilt on the gingerbread. This is not changing the substance of the place I work, and I still don't like it here.
Yes, I know, and there is a very fine line you have to walk here. And if the employees at any point get the impression that they're trying to manipulate us into being happy, even though things are still lousy around here, if you get that, you will get a massive revolt against happiness at work, and everyone will become less happy. So what you really need here is for management to demonstrate a commitment to happiness at work, to show that, you know, we're serious about this. We're now making it our number one priority. We're doing this for our own sakes, we're doing it for your sakes, and we're doing it for the sake of the company.
Back at the Open University in Britain, for Jane Henry, there is much more to happiness at work than fun.
People who have more control over their own lives, over what they're doing and how they're doing it, tend to be more content than those who have less control. And so organisations are places that can help feed into that. They can offer flexi-time, for example, so people have more control over which hours they work. Lots of studies to show that those people who have that time and also, for example, home workers, teleworkers, may be more productive than those who don't. So not only are people happier, but they're also better workers.
Balance up to date there for you.
Thank you. 20, 40, 60, 80, 100. Here in Derby, I've come to another good company to work for, as assessed in the Sunday Times. This is the Derby branch of the Britannia Building Society, a place proud of its flexible work patterns for staff, the career growth and development they're offered, and how the managers listen to the people who work for them. The branch manager, Louise Waite, joined only recently from a competitor. She's noticed, she says, a definite difference. Without mentioning your previous employer, is this better?
Yes, a lot better.
Why?
Better. Because at Britannia, they concentrate on the customer and the employee. It's not all about how they're making the money. It's the customer is priority, but the staff also get the benefits as well. And you can go home every single day and think, I've done the best for that person, but that's how we've been trained, how we want to do it, really.
And that's the top difference, is it? The other things about, oh, being able to complain or suggest or, you know, being listened to a lot, that comes second to this involvement.
It does for me personally, yes. I mean, we didn't have anything like the employee survey or anything like that. We had it once a year, but we didn't feel like we got listened to. Here we do. We have meetings once a month, once a quarter in the branch network where employees will go and they'll have a look at the survey and they will put their opinion forward to why they want that change in and how we can change it. And that's then taken on board. So
you feel noticeably happier, or rather more job satisfied here than you did in your old job?
Definitely, 100%.
Did you know this was going to happen when you joined?
Only by talking to people that I knew that had worked here, and they currently still work here, and that's why I came to Britannia.
But it's important to remember, after the disasters at privatised Northern Rock and Bradford and Bingley, that Britannia has remained a mutual building society. It's still owned by its members, who do a lot of their saving and borrowing over the counter here, in close contact with the staff. Tim Franklin is the Britannia's Managing Director for Member Business. I put it to him that this mutuality is probably an important component in being a good place to work.
I think it gives us a strong sense of responsibility of who we are, what we stand for, and who really matters in our organisation, Peter. Every time the door opens in our branch and somebody walks in, it's an owner. They own us. They're a member of this organisation. That's why we're here. We better make sure we get it right for them.
nearly every chief executive in the world will say people are our most important asset, then what happens doesn't necessarily sort of bear that out, does it?
It's important to make sure that you're sincere in everything that you do. Our responsibility of leaders is to act with integrity, and in this organisation, our people really are our greatest asset. We invest heavily in them through a variety of different things, through our Britannia Management Academy, improving their skills and capability. Our people recognise their colleagues through our Living the Values Awards. We have regular captain's tables, which our group chief executive runs, at which he invites people across the business to come and tell him about the real issues inside our business. Communication's at the fore of making sure we understand what matters to our employees.
But what is new about all this, really? Respect your staff as human beings and they'll respect the business in return. Is that all there is to it, Danish happiness expert Alexander Kjerulf?
We've been stuck with an industrial style of management where it's about getting people to do as they're told. And this is actually the opposite. This is about getting people to do more than they're told, you know, to get them to be engaged. It's not something you can induce. You said, can you induce this in employees? Well, you can, but it needs to be a two-way street. If you just want, you know, we want the employees to care about the company. We want, you know, we want them to care about the results. It has to be a two-way street. That means the company must care about the employees. If there's not a genuine commitment to the happiness of the employees, it cannot work.
If we look at the roots of all this, historically, it all goes back to Henry Ford's wonderful production line in Detroit, where he had to make the jobs interchangeable and low-skilled because all the skilled engineers had gone to make railway carriages, so he needed to break down work into repeatable parts that anybody could do.
Yes.
And the foremen in the system were the very important whippers-in, weren't they? They were the people who kept the worker machine grinding it out, and that was so successful that it imprinted itself into every other kind of business, service or manufacturing, and into management thought so deeply. And
we're
struggling to get away from that still, aren't we?
We are. And I think it was Henry Ford who said that. Why is it that every time I need to hire a pair of hands, I get an entire human being? And of course, today we want the exact opposite. We want people to be engaged and focused and committed and creative and innovative. We want more than just a pair of hands. We want the whole human being. And you don't get that if people are not happy at work.
The view from Mr. Corporate Happiness, the opposite of Hamlet, the cheery Dane. But how about other values? The much talked about work-life balance, for example. If work is so wonderfully rewarding, then perhaps we ought to be prepared to sacrifice our lives to it in the way that American workers and bosses are supposed to. It's time for a visit to the think tank The Work Foundation, where the Associate Director Stephen Overall says there's been a recent fundamental shift in our attitude to work.
If you wanted to be slightly sociological about it, some people talk about the post-material issues that are now attached to work. So that's not just thinking about the very traditional things like pay and terms and conditions and management and leadership, but also about what you might say are the sort of post-material issues of fulfillment, doing something worthwhile, making a difference, realizing yourself, how compatible your work is with your identity, how work fits with your ethical outlook on the world, all these kind of issues, these sort of package of issues, they're really very new, but I think they're becoming more important and more prominent as the 21st century unfolds.
Companies keep on saying they want their staff to grow and develop with them, to flourish professionally and personally. Stephen Overall has doubts about this.
The thought of an organisation going out to design a fulfilling culture, it makes me rather nervous. It speaks of 1950s organisation man. It speaks of Aldous Huxley's Brave New World of trying to hatch employees out of incubators. It's not like that. I mean, I think they'd be much, much better off thinking in terms of craftsmanship, if you like, or craftswomanship, about how to sort of put people in the position to sort of use their skills to the best of their abilities to produce excellent goods and services, and then a corporate culture or a corporate mission should flow from that. It shouldn't just be sort of laid on top of it.
That goes to addresses the bee in my bonnet that companies have got dislocated from their purposes, because a company gets to a certain size and has so many divisions and departments and fiefdoms and baronies and silos, as the word is, that they get away from making things. And so you're there working in a department that does something seemingly very detached from the purpose of the business, without any pleasure from customer satisfaction or anything else. So it's all targets and can we reach them this quarter and all that kind of thing. And you're kind of making work into the production line machine that we were supposed to be getting away from.
Well, I think there's a lot in that. I think there's two central forces that are sort of menacing the life of all people who are looking for a sense of craft or fulfillment. One of those is sort of galloping bureaucracy, the sense of splitting tasks into smaller and smaller elements. I mean, you can think of call centres, you can think of burger bars, but also you can think of organisations. They're often extremely bureaucratic, often divided into sharply defined silos, and with a very small number of different tasks that they have to do. I think that's one. All these things sort of menace the life of the craftsman a little bit. And then I think, secondly, market forces can work against that defining core purpose of great organisations sometimes. In the sort of rush to compete, they sometimes lose their way, and the sort of sense of one strategy after another strategy after another strategy, and suddenly they don't know quite what they're all about anymore.
So you say work in one place, companies, business in one place, and workers, or rather people, in another place. Don't mix them up too intensely. Don't align them too much.
Well, in a way, I think you can take it so far, and I think the best organisations manage to take it so far. So they enable a sense of happiness by well-designed jobs, strategic direction, excellent products and services. I think all these things are very worthwhile, and I'm certainly not running them down. But I think taking it a step further towards companies deliberately setting out to offer their employees meaning and fulfillment, I think this speaks of an agenda that rather clashes with meaning, because what individuals are after is really something that they define subjectively. It's work of substance and significance. It's work that fits with their ethical outlook on the world, that is compatible with their identity. And organisations, they're simply not in a position to meet all these things, and it takes work to a level of inflated expectations, if you like, that may ultimately be quite unhelpful, because you're no longer offering someone a secure job and pay and terms and conditions. You're seeking to offer a sort of set of psychological goods. And although this is very new in the history of the world, it does have a sort of shadow of organisational Big Brother about it.
Stephen Overall at the Work Foundation, reminding us that maybe work and life should not be too thoroughly mixed up. Maybe companies can't do too much about trying to make their workers happy and contented, because it could be counterproductive. But if it just happens to happen, well, they're very lucky businesses indeed.
In Business was presented by Peter Day. The producer was Ruth Alexander, and the editor was Stephen Shilcott. Next week, the programme goes shopping in the New India. If you've missed past editions of In Business, we keep a permanent archive of most of the programmes going back over the past 4 years, and you can access these via the link on our webpage on the right-hand side called Previous Programmes. To get to the In Business page, visit the Radio 4 website and follow the links. This has been a podcast from the BBC. For more information and for our terms and conditions, visit www.bbc.co.uk.